From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on Ukraine and the tensions over Crimea. The search for that missing Malaysian jetliner. European Union calling the Iran nuclear talks useful, plus some changes on shoring up the U.S. economy. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukraine says it has drawn up plans to evacuate all of its outnumbered military personnel from the Crimean Peninsula. The move, announced on Wednesday, effectively surrenders military control of the territory as heavily armed pro-Russian militiamen seized a key Crimean base. In announcing the withdrawal, Ukraine's National Security Defense Council Chief Andriy Poruby said Kiev will seek United Nations support in turning the peninsula into a demilitarized zone. He also said Ukraine is planning to hold military maneuvers with our allies, as he put it. He did not elaborate. Poruby spoke hours after pro-Russian militiamen seized Ukrainian naval headquarters in the Crimean port of Sevastopol, and one day after Moscow signed a treaty with local authorities, making Crimea part of Russia. Witnesses are saying that at least 200 unarmed self-defense forces entered Sevastopol, the base there, on Wednesday and raised the Russian flag. And Ukrainian service personnel did not resist, we are told, and were seen leaving the facility. Russian news agencies quoted sources in Sevastopol as saying the prosecutor's office it believes the commander of Ukraine's Navy had been temporarily detained after leaving the Navy headquarters. Later on Wednesday, there were reports that a second Ukrainian base had been seized by Russian forces. Now we go to the United Nations, where VOA's Margaret Bashir reports that Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is headed to Moscow in a bid to help diplomatically resolve the crisis over Crimea.
Mr. Ban's office said he will arrive in the Russian capital on Thursday and meet with President Vladimir Putin. He will also hold discussions with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and other senior officials. On Friday, he will continue to Ukraine, where he will meet with Interim President Oleksandr Churchinov and Interim Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk, as well as other key officials. UN spokesman Farhan Haq reiterated that the Secretary General has been hoping for a diplomatic resolution of the situation.
He's consistently called for de-escalation and for restraint. And so he's going to press that point with the authorities in both Russia and Ukraine. He believes the focus has to be to engage in direct dialogue between Moscow and Kiev, aimed at agreeing on specific measures that will pave the way for a diplomatic resolution. And he believes that the path for a diplomatic resolution remains open if the parties choose to embrace it.
On Sunday, the Crimean region of Ukraine conducted a hastily held referendum under the watch of thousands of Russian troops, voting to secede from Ukraine with the intention of joining the Russian Federation. Ukraine's interim authorities have declared the vote illegal under the country's constitution. With the situation seemingly intractable, what can the UN chief hope to accomplish? American University Professor of International Relations Michael Schroeder says in part Mr. Ban's trip is about keeping the possibility of a peace process open.
I think he sees his job partially as to make sure that there is a process in place to sort of, number one, deter, you know, the great powers in the Security Council from feeling it can sort of wash its hands of the process or anything like that. But I also just think that he's sort of hoping, number one, little steps he can sort of negotiate on the sidelines of the sort of bigger issues, the sidelines, things like human rights monitors getting in, making sure the special representative can potentially get in on the ground and monitor and report back to the council.
Schroeder says the Secretary General's presence could also provide an opportunity for the Russians to open a dialogue with the Ukrainians if they wanted to. So far, they do not recognize the interim government in Kiev and have rejected the prospect of talks. But if they wanted to begin discussions, Schroeder says it might be easier for Moscow to let Mr. Ban facilitate it than, for instance, Washington. During his brief trip, the Secretary General will also meet with members of a UN human rights monitoring mission while he is in Kiev. The UN has sought to get monitors into Crimea to assess the situation on the ground. UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights Ivan Simonovich just returned from a trip to the Ukraine. He will brief the Security Council on his findings during a meeting Wednesday afternoon. Deputy Secretary General Jan Eliasson will also brief council members on the latest developments. Earlier Wednesday, Russian forces took over a Ukrainian naval base in the Crimean port city of Sevastopol. That followed the fatal shooting of a Ukrainian soldier in the regional capital on Tuesday, prompting Ukraine's prime minister to warn that the crisis had shifted from a political to a military stage. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Earlier this week, President Vladimir Putin spoke to the upper house of the Russian parliament, telling them he isn't aiming to split up Ukraine, but ethnic Russians say they still want to join the Russian Federation, just like Crimea did. The story now from VOA's Jamie Detmer in Donetsk, in eastern Ukraine, not far from the border with Russia.
It is a frigid evening in Donetsk, Lenin Square, but the cold has not deterred a small crowd from maintaining a weeks-long protest against the new Ukraine government in Kiev. They say they want to join Crimea and break with Ukraine and join the Russian Federation. 70-year-old Denis says the new government in Kiev is making everyone poorer and the people of eastern Ukraine can't live with the politicians of the capital anymore. Vera is 62 years old and says she'd like Donetsk to stay in Ukraine, but that ethnic Russians are being forced to ask Mr. Putin to help because the politicians in Kiev don't care about the east of Ukraine and they just think of themselves. Donetsk is in the heart of the Donbass coalfield and is one of Ukraine's major industrial cities. The activists in Lenin Square are demanding the release of an activist who briefly proclaimed himself People's Governor of the region this month. And they praise the actions of Russian separatists in Crimea, who stormed a Ukrainian naval base in the Crimean city of Sevastopol. This a day after Crimean leaders signed a treaty with Russia, absorbing the peninsula into the Russian Federation after a disputed referendum. Ukraine's new leaders are becoming increasingly anxious about the protests in the eastern Ukraine cities that are home to large numbers of ethnic Russians. Protests have mounted, and over the weekend violence flared when more than 5,000 pro-Russian protesters roamed central Donetsk, smashing doors and windows and forcing entry to government buildings. Three have died in the recent protests in eastern Ukraine. Kiev's politicians claim Moscow has been infiltrating Russian provocateurs to incite much of the agitation, an allegation also levelled by US Secretary of State John Kerry. The Kremlin denies this and has warned it is ready to send forces massed on the border to protect ethnic Russians, the initial reason given for seizing Crimea. Pro-Russian activists deny the claims, flashing Ukrainian passports to show they come from Donetsk. The country's new leaders, who replaced President Viktor Yanukovych, ousted in February after months of street protests against his rule, are trying to dampen ethnic Russian agitation by offering reforms. They are promising greater decentralization while preserving the unity of Ukraine, which will give the region, cities and districts broad powers and the funding needed for their development. But one of the first moves by Ukraine's parliament after Yanukovych fled to Russia still rankles here. The lawmakers passed legislation abolishing a law that allows regions to use Russian as a second official language. The acting president vetoed that abolition, but ethnic Russians point to it as evidence showing what Kiev really thinks of them. Atom, a 36-year-old small businessman, says it is too late for reforms. Donetsk should be part of the Russian Federation and says that would be best. Despite President Putin's indication Tuesday that he has no more designs on Ukrainian territory, Ukrainians fear that he may now be preparing more land grabs of ethnic Russian-dominated areas. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Donetsk.
And you can keep up to date with what's happening in Ukraine by going to our website at voanews.com. Still ahead, the latest on the missing Malaysian passenger plane.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Day 13 of the search for that missing Malaysia Air passenger plane is underway, and there are still no firm indications of what happened to the plane, which lost contact with air traffic controllers about an hour after taking off from Kuala Lumpur International Airport on March 8 en route to Beijing. Progressively, each day since then, the families of the 239 people on board that flight, number 370, have shown signs of frustration about getting few answers about the fate of their relatives. One unidentified woman directed her frustration at a Malaysia Airlines official. She said she was fed up with getting no answers and that all she and the others can do is vent their anger and cry. She went on to say, aside from lying, deceiving, you have been playing the gangster. Two-thirds of the plane's 227 passengers were Chinese. Many of their families have become increasingly angry, as we heard, about what they feel is contradictory or confusing information released by Malaysia. Some have even threatened a hunger strike. Malaysian security forces forcibly removed the wailing Chinese relatives from the press room on Wednesday and blocked the entrance, that is, as scores of international and local media recorded the incident. Once the news conference did begin, Malaysian Defense Minister Hisham Mudin Hussein said authorities are trying our very best to locate the plane and to narrow the search area, which now covers more than 7 million square kilometers. The minister, who is leading the multinational operation, said he understands that emotions are high. He said Malaysia is sending another high-level delegation to Beijing to explain more details of the search. Among the dozens of countries helping the search for that missing plane and in the investigation is the United States. U.S. military has been actively involved, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation is staying in touch with officials in Malaysia. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, under whose aegis the FBI operates, spoke to reporters in Washington on Wednesday.
With regard to the plane crash, we are working with the authorities in Malaysia. We're trying to offer whatever assistance that we can. But at this point, I don't think we have any theories that I could propound.
Mr. Holder, have you spoken to your counterpart in Malaysia? Have you asked them to accept some more help from the FBI, which is standing ready to help if they so desire?
I've not had direct contact with my counterpart in Malaysia, but there has been contact between the various investigative agencies, the FBI here, and the relevant agencies in Malaysia. And those conversations are ongoing.
Mr. Attorney General, you said that you don't have any theories. Does that mean that you don't agree with Malaysian authorities who say that this was a deliberate act?
Well, I think that we are still in the process of trying to determine what happened there, and we're helping in any way that we can.
Do you wish you could offer more help? Have you reached out to them and said that there's been some conflict about whether they'd give the FBI access to the flight simulators?
But we are in ongoing conversations about how we can help, and we will make available whatever resources that we have, whatever expertise we have that we might be able to be used.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder's comments came after officials in Malaysia said investigators there, with the help of the FBI, are trying to restore files deleted last month from the home flight simulator of the pilot aboard the missing plane. Police in Malaysia said files containing records of simulations carried out on the program were deleted on February the 3rd from the device found in the home of the Malaysian Airlines pilot, Captain Zahari Ahmed Shah. Also in the news, the latest round of talks on Iran's nuclear program ended in Vienna on Wednesday, with officials indicating there was progress, but provided few details. VOA's Al Pessin is following the story.
What was not long ago major news is now routine. The Iranian foreign minister and the European Union's foreign policy chief appeared together for brief statements with smiles all around. The EU's Catherine Ashton said they will meet again in less than 3 weeks, with lower-level officials continuing technical talks in the meantime.
Based on the framework for the negotiations established at our meeting last month, we had substantive and useful discussions covering a set of issues, including enrichment, the Arak reactor, civil nuclear cooperation, and sanctions.
Officials say the lack of details indicates that the talks are serious. The negotiators are working toward permanent limits on Iran's nuclear program to guarantee it's only for peaceful purposes, as Iran says it is. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif repeated that in an opinion column in the Financial Times newspaper on Wednesday. He also wrote that Iran will insist on continuing to enrich uranium and that reaching an agreement will require far more courage than has been displayed so far. Some analysts expressed concern that the Crimea issue would affect these talks. Russia is part of the international negotiating team authorized by the UN Security Council, as are the United States and several European countries, all of which have sharply criticized Russia's moves to annex Crimea. But officials say the international team remains united on the Iran issue, including Russia. And Jim Walsh of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Security Studies Program thinks he knows why.
Russia does not want a nuclear Iran near its territory, and that national interest has not changed. But I think it is something to keep an eye on. Sometimes these disagreements and conflicts spread in unexpected ways.
Walsh notes that past U.S.-Russia and U.S.-Soviet negotiations have continued in spite of disagreements over other issues. But Ali Nader of the RAND Corporation says Russia could take other steps to show its displeasure with the West, like selling missiles to Iran.
Although Russia is not going to derail the nuclear negotiations, it could cozy up to Iran or use Iran to offset U.S. power in the Middle East, because that's what's it has done in the past.
But even with those concerns, some officials and experts now say a comprehensive agreement on Iran's nuclear program is possible, even likely, by the mid-July deadline. Many had assumed that would have to be extended if agreement could be reached at all. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Israeli airstrikes in the Golan Heights have killed one Syrian soldier, wounded seven in the most serious escalation between the two neighbors since Syria's civil war broke out 3 years ago. Syria's military confirmed the casualties from the strikes, which came in response to an attack Tuesday on Israeli forces across the Israeli-Syrian ceasefire line in the Golan. Both sides issued stark warnings following the incidents. Israeli military officials said the targets Wednesday included an army training facility, military headquarters, and artillery batteries that had aided and abetted the earlier attack on the Israeli army patrol. The bomb attack was the third such incident along Israel's northern border in less than 2 weeks, and the first to cause Israeli casualties. Four soldiers were wounded, one of them severely. Unrest in Egypt has resulted in at least seven deaths as security forces raided a militant hideout near Cairo and police fired tear gas at Islamist demonstrators in the capital. Edward Uranian is in Cairo with our report.
Egypt's interior ministry says two officers were killed along with five militants when Egyptian police, military, and special forces clashed with Islamist militants during a raid on a reported safe house of the Sinai-based group Ansar Beit al-Maqdis just north of Cairo. The militants opened fire on security forces and set off the car bombs, sparking a gun battle that lasted several hours, the ministry said. The group has stepped up attacks on Egyptian security forces since the military ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi last year. Last week, militants ambushed a military police checkpoint in Kalyupia, killing a number of young policemen. Also Wednesday, an Egyptian court sentenced more than two dozen Islamists, many in absentia, to death over violent attacks in the port city of Suez. One man was also given a 15-year sentence. Elsewhere in the Egyptian capital, police fired volleys of tear gas at clusters of young men around Cairo University after a protest by Muslim Brotherhood students spilled into the main boulevard facing the campus. The protesters pelted police with stones and bottles in streets near the university. Police prevented protesters at Al-Azhar University on the opposite side of Cairo from going off campus, although young men threw stones at passing vehicles and police. Egyptian media also reported scattered clashes in Nasrut and several other towns across the country. The Muslim Brotherhood website accused police of assaulting students at Al-Azhar University and claimed the protests marked a new revolution. But the protests were fairly small compared to many in the 3 years since a popular uprising toppled longtime President Hosni Mubarak in February 2011. Former Egyptian senator and American University of Cairo political science professor Mona Makram Obeid tells VOA she thinks the Muslim Brotherhood is hoping to prolong the uncertainty and instability in Egypt by calling for more protests.
These protests have been going on for quite a long time now, disturbing the students who want to continue to study and who have exams coming up. But, of course, this is all instigated by the Muslim Brothers who want to continue this state of, you know, of turmoil, of violence, of uncertainty, particularly with the approach of the new presidential elections.
The Wednesday protests came as many Egyptians expected an announcement by Defense Minister Abdel Fattah el-Sisi that he would resign his post to run for president. Egypt's Masra el-Yom newspaper said the announcement would take place on Wednesday or by Thursday at the latest. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Newly installed chairperson of the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, has announced further cutbacks to its economic stimulus for the U.S. economy. In her first press conference on Wednesday, Janet Yellen also hinted that there could be a rise in short-term interest rates from record lows muted for early 2015.
The committee states that in determining how long to maintain the current 0 to 1/4% target range for the federal funds rate, it will assess progress, both realized and expected, toward its objectives of maximum employment and 2% inflation.
Her words were the clearest indication so far of when the Federal Reserve might raise its benchmark short-term rate, which has been at a record low near zero since 2008. The central bank said it would cut its monthly long-term bond purchases by another $10 billion to $55 billion because it thinks the economy is strong enough to support further improvements in the job market.
The central tendency of the unemployment rate projections has shifted down by about 2/10 since December and now stands at between 6.1 and 6.3% at the end of this year. The unemployment rate is projected to reach its longer-run normal level by the end of 2016.
And although central bank officials expect the U.S. economy to grow at a steady, if modest, pace in 2014, it blames setbacks on the bad weather.
Unusually harsh weather in January and February has made assessing the underlying strength of the economy especially challenging.
Indeed. In fact, Janet Yellen, the U.S. Central Bank chief, was speaking on Wednesday here in Washington. A lot of rain on the ground here. Well, on Wall Street, stocks retreated in late afternoon trading on Wednesday after the Yellen announcements. The Dow Jones Industrial Average ended the session down 114 points at 16,222, but had fallen as much as 209 points after the announcement was made. Standard & Poor's 500 index fell 0.6% to close at 1860 on Wednesday. The NASDAQ composite fell 0.6% to 4,307. And with all those numbers said, it's time to say goodbye from International Edition here on The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. A reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Kelvin Fowler, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On March 20th, 1815, Napoleon entered Paris with his army after escaping from exile, beginning his so-called 100 Days Rule. 5 days later, some leading nations in Europe formed a coalition to remove Napoleon from power, thus setting off the Napoleonic Wars. The series of conflicts ended in defeat for Napoleon and his return to exile. On this day in 1852, American abolitionist and author Harriet Beecher Stowe published her classic book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. The novel had a profound effect on public opinion concerning black slavery in the American South. In 1854, the Republican Party of the United States was organized in Ripon, Wisconsin. In 1904, behavioral psychologist, author, and philosopher B.F. Skinner was born in Susquehanna, Pennsylvania. In 1942, U.S. General Douglas MacArthur, following a harrowing escape from approaching Japanese forces in the Philippines, vowed, "I will return." 2 years later, in 1944, MacArthur headed the American Army that liberated the Philippines from Japanese control. In 1967, the Motown girl group known as the Supremes released this hit song. The Happening was the theme song for a movie of the same name. The movie flopped, but the song reached number one on Billboard magazine's Hot 100 in May of that year. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Women, youth, and civil society are fundamental to the post-2015 development agenda at the United Nations. The U.S. representative to the UN Economic and Social Council, Ambassador Elizabeth Cousins, said if we are serious about tackling inequalities and exclusion, and if we are serious about a truly transformative development agenda, we need women, girls, and youth to be at the heart and soul of our work. There has been considerable progress in creating greater access to education and improving some health outcomes. However, progress has been uneven, and women and girls are among the most falling behind. Women make up the majority of young people unable to read or write. They lack equal access to jobs and livelihoods, and they face persistent discrimination and inequality in many areas. Women and girls continue to face early and forced marriage, health risks from childbirth, underrepresentation in political decision-making and institutions, and the pervasive scourge of violence. Nearly one in three women globally are beaten, coerced into sex, or physically abused in some other way. Investing in women has many development benefits. A child born to a mother who can read and write, for example, is 50% more likely to survive past the age of five. It is crucial that the post-2015 development agenda target quality education, increase political participation, and the elimination of sexual-based violence, including early and forced marriage. Today, youth make up more than half the world's population, yet far too many live in conditions of insecurity, poverty, or vulnerability that limits their prospects. Development goals need to target their specific needs, including addressing the issue of vocational skills, as upwards of 75 million youth are unemployed globally. Finally, the bedrock of all these development efforts is civil society. Governments and institutions are stronger when citizens have a voice in public policy debates and decision-making that affects them. If we care about advancing a shared development agenda, said Ambassador Cousins, we must continue to press for a safe and open environment for civil society and citizen action. The United States strongly supports the inclusion in the post-2015 development agenda of women and girls, youth, and the institutions that promote healthy civil society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.